Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Wide, 90 feet tall by 9 feet wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that he set up. Then all of those people were assembled in the dedication of the image. And then the herald loudly proclaimed and said, "To you the command is given, O people, nations, men and women of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe," oh, Scottish people were there, "and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace, of the blazing fire." So here's the situation. The king has set up this large statue, right? This golden statue on this plain. And he gathers all the people from all different languages, all different nations, and all the people who are running the government. And he says, "Come here for the dedication, and when the music plays, I want you to bow down and worship this God that I have made." For this reason, so then everybody did that. But for this reason, at the time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the music," it lists all the instruments, "whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of the fire. There are certain Jews who you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They did not serve your gods and worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring them in front of him. So they bring him in front of him, and he says, "Is it true, you guys, that you did not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready, at the moment you hear the music, to fall down and worship the image I have made, very immediately, it will all be well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of the blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, and they said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he answered by giving the order to heat the furnace 7 times more hotter than it usually was. So he heats up the furnace, and he gets some guards to bind them up and take them to the furnace. And it's so hot that it says as they were casting them into the furnace, the guards died, right? It was so hot. And so they're cast in there. And then he says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, 'Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?' And they replied to the king, 'Yeah, certainly.' And he said, 'Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods.' And then Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the furnace and said, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here.' And then they came out, and they didn't have any burnt hair. They didn't smell like smoke or anything. And he says, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielding their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their house is reduced to rubbish, to a rubbish heap." This is Scottish. "And inasmuch as there is no other God who will deliver them in this way." So that's the story. Fantastic story. I think we're all edified. Let's pray and go home. Right? Like, what else do we need to say? That's a fantastic story of these 3 men who stood up in the midst of being asked to do something that was against their beliefs, and they were like, "We're not going to worship this other God." And then they pay the consequence. They get thrown into the furnace. And then there's this fourth person in there with them. And then the king sees them and is like, oh, man. And brings them out and says, you guys went against what I said, but I see that your God has saved you out of this. And so nobody can, again, say anything against this God because it is the Most High God. That's a fantastic story. I have never dealt with any kind of persecution like this, right? Maybe here in Portland, I don't know if anybody's going to throw us in a furnace for going to church. I do think that we get a little bit of shaming, right? Like, probably the biggest persecution we get is some friends of yours might be like, hey, we're going to go to brunch, you know, the official religion of Portland, at 10:30 on Sunday, and you'd be like, I can't come, I have church. And then they'd be like, oh, church? Ooh. Don't you know religion is destroying communities, right? That's what they would say. That's probably the biggest persecution we get in Portland. Not going to brunch. But I think this story is fantastic. And I want to talk about a few things and then go into something that that really struck me as I was reading this passage this week. So why do we tell this story is kind of the first question. Why is the story told? We tell stories because they encourage us, right? The book of Daniel has some really fantastic stories. And this story and those stories were told over and over again by Jews who were living under a persecuting empire. And so they would remind themselves of these stories that God is faithful, even in the midst of empirical rule, even in the midst of being asked to do things that are against their way. And they would encourage one another by telling these stories. And that's what faith is, right? We come together because at a certain part in our life, we maybe lose sight of the narrative we believe in. We maybe are confronted with things that deeply, deeply affect us, and we get together and we remind ourselves of who God is and how he's been faithful to us in the past, because faith is taking those remembrances and applying it to the present and going, that same God will be in the midst of our trials now, right? So that's why we tell those stories. Why a statue? So you can go to the next slide. So in the chapter before, King Nebuchadnezzar has this crazy dream, and I asked Kurt if you guys talked about this, and he said you did. So he had this dream, and there's this statue that had the head of gold, and then the body of silver, then bronze, and then iron mixed with clay, right? And then this rock that no human hand had cut comes out of nowhere and crushes those things. And nobody knows what this vision is, and Daniel comes to the king and says, I know what your vision was, and tells him, and the king's like, oh my gosh, you know everything, your God knows everything, and makes Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego part of kind of the royal leadership, right? So some scholars believe that why Nebuchadnezzar builds this golden statue, which, let's be honest, you know, leaders, megalomaniac leaders tend to have a like to make big things to let everybody know they have big things, right? And I don't think it's that far-fetched to go that some of it is, here's this male king who's like building this very narrow and tall thing to worship, and he's like, look at my big thing. So I, you know, there's that. But yeah, because people with a lot of power do ridiculous stuff. But there, some of the stuff that I read is that some scholars are saying, look, you know, Nebuchadnezzar probably lost sight of the vision of the rock that destroys everything, because the point of the vision was saying all of these kingdoms will be built over throughout time, but they're all going to fall, but the kingdom that will last forever is the one that God is building. And just like any leader who's given a lot of power, they're obsessed with their legacy, right? And so Nebuchadnezzar is told that you are that golden part of that statue. And then he sees that the statue becomes less and less precious and eventually is muddled, the metal and the clay, so it's very brittle. And in his mind, he's like, I don't want this to be destroyed. I'm being told that this is going to fall apart. What can I do to control this? And what I need to do is I need to gather all the differences that are in my kingdom that will potentially break all this apart. And I need to find a unifying way to bring them all under one rule. And what I can do is I can give them a God that they would all worship. And they would all be under this rule and this God and this sovereignty. If I can create that, I can create the unity that will keep this kingdom going, right? Now, it's interesting that this story has nothing to do with politics now. And it's probably the story, the way we should approach this sermon, but I got to be honest with you, I don't feel very qualified to do a political talk, although this this passage has a lot of political ramifications and how we live in systems that are trying to get us to be unified, but actually are based in human power and not God's power. But the thing that really struck me this week out of this passage was the statement that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, apparently all speaking together in one voice, say to the king. And they say, "We are not going to worship your God because our God is going to save us out of your hands." And go to the next slide. But even if he doesn't, where does that come from? Like, where does a statement like that come from out of these three men? So I kind of want to just spend a few minutes talking about that, about faith and trust and where this comes from. Because this is a conversation that they had or they did in their own lives before they would ever be confronted in front of a king. There's a guy named Dave Chappelle, who's fantastic, and he's a comedian. He has a show called The Chappelle Show. So it was very popular a few years ago. It still is popular. You can watch it in reruns. But season 3 of The Chappelle Show, Dave just walked off the set and got on a plane and flew to Africa and disappeared for like 3 or 4 months. And he came back, and the first interview he did after coming back was with James Lipton on In the Actor's Studio. And I want to show a clip from that conversation. So Dave Chappelle had this very successful show, and there was talk about, you know, a few years ago, this $50 million for another series was like a lot of money. It still is a lot of money. But they end up having this conversation, you can watch the whole interview on YouTube. It's very fascinating because he's very raw, and he doesn't care at all, and he's just very honest. But they have this conversation, and let's watch this clip.
How old were you when you made your first TV development deal?
19. My mother and my grandmother were freaked out. You know, I was the first person in my family not to go to college that had not been a slave.
Right.
So I was really breaking from tradition, and it was like a graduation lunch we were having, and they had my dad come and talk to me, and my dad takes me outside, and he's like, "Listen," and this is some advice that applies to all you acting students. He says, "To be an actor is a lonely life. Everybody wants to make it, and you might not make it." And I said to my dad, well, that depends on what making it is, Dad. He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you're a teacher." I said, "If I could make a teacher's salary doing comedy, I think that's better than being a teacher." And he started laughing. He said, "If you keep that attitude, I think you should go." He said, "But name your price in the beginning. If it ever gets more expensive than the price you name, get out of there." Thus, after. Oh, man. Yeah, oh, you guys are going to learn a lot tonight.
What can they learn?
You know, like, you guys are students now, so you're idealists, but you don't know about where art and corporate interests meet yet. Just prepare to have your heart broken. Like, in a way. You see him laughing, that evil laugh? Because he knows, man, and everybody laughs at me, but just get your Africa tickets ready, baby, because it's coming. It's coming.
So I think when we think about relationships and faith, you know, when we think about the idea of trust, we can go to the next slide. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had a bit of scripture at the time. Like, it hadn't been formed into what we know as the Old Testament now, but they had writings from Moses and David and Solomon and these. And so they most likely would have known this verse or this from the Proverbs, where The writer of Proverbs says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all of your ways acknowledge him and he will make your path straight." This is a great verse. I learned this when I was a kid, right? I've had it throughout my whole life. But trust in the Lord with all your heart. And thinking about trust, it's interesting to me, and I think Chappelle hits on it, is that all of our experiences with trust as human beings is broken. There's not one of us who've ever had a relationship that has been 100% broken free of trust, right? And I think inwardly, in any kind of relationship or commitment that we enter into, we have this unidentified conversation that is like, I will stick with this until my price is named, right? I will stick in this until you name my price and then I'm out. And I'm sure all of us in some parts of our faith and our walk with God have hit moments in our life that were so painful or like we didn't expect or we didn't think that believing in God would ever allow us to come to this spot. And then we were at that spot where we go, I think this is my price has been named and I don't think I believe this anymore, right? And I think what's interesting about this verse as I've meditated on it, can you go back to it again? It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. And I don't necessarily think that always just means about like how we know what's going on in the world, but maybe it also means like on our knowing of what trust really is. Maybe we're being invited into a trust that we'll never experience in this realm, like with each other, because we're broken and that trust is broken, but we're invited into a trust that we don't know about. My senior year in, you can go to the next slide. I thought about doing a Q word like cucumber for next slide, but I would think we'll just do next slide. Because just saying cucumber throughout the whole talk would be weird. My senior year in college, I got invited to go on this trip to New Zealand. And it was a fantastic story of how I got there. But it was with a group of men and women who were these really wonderful Christians. And the goal of the kind of the time together was to learn what it meant to just live a life with Jesus. And there was many adventures, and it was really great. But I met this guy named Bart Tarman, who at the time was the chaplain of Westmont College down in Santa Barbara. And because Bart spent his years being the chaplain in colleges and had talked with thousands and thousands of college students, because I was the only college student on the trip, I think he just identified me and was like, hey, Scott, we should hang out sometime. And I was like, I would love that. Let's have a conversation. He's like, yeah, let's meet tomorrow for a coffee. But he's like, I want to ask you a question that we could talk about. And he's like, you don't have to answer it now. I want to propose this question to you and think about it for the night, and then we'll talk about it tomorrow. I was like, great, that sounds great. And so he goes, here's the question. According to Jesus, what is the gospel? So don't answer it now. Just think about it tonight. Come up with an answer, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. So I spent the evening thinking about it, going, okay, that's interesting. And then we got together the next day, and we sat down, and he's like, and we started talking just to get to know each other a little bit more. And then he's like, hey, did you think about my question that I asked you? And I was like, yeah, I did. I put some thought into it. And he said, what do you think? And I proceeded to start as saying the Romans Road. Now, if you know what this is, if you ever spent time in any kind of church, the Romans Road is a way to like take verses out of Romans and then make this kind of like, I guess, theology of salvation, right? So Romans 3:10, no one is righteous, not even one. And then like all of, for the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life. And while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And so it goes through this whole thing about salvation, which is funny that I answered wrongly, right? I didn't even answer according to Jesus. I answered Paul. Theology. Anyways. And so I gave my whole answer. And Bart was like, yeah, you're not wrong, right? He's like, you're not wrong. But he's like, it's a bit of a trick question. He's like, look, I've asked this to thousands of college students, and only three have ever gotten it right on the first time. And he's like, the last guy who got it right spent 3 months answering this question, and we got together, and he's like, Bart, I read the gospel, four gospels four times in a row. And he's like, I think I got it down to one verse. And Bart's like, that's great. And he's like, actually, it's like half a verse. And Bart's like, okay, that's fantastic. He's like, actually, it's like a phrase. Bart's like, even better. And he's like, actually, it's just three words. And Bart's like, would you just tell me? And he goes, I think what the gospel is according to Jesus is come to me. Come to me. And he's like, see, Scott, what you said isn't necessarily wrong, but what you gave to me was a list of ideas that I needed to believe in. You said, For all have sinned, and no one is righteous, and not even one. Well, not everybody believes that. You can go to the next slide. And in order to meet Jesus, you're giving me this list of things that I need to believe in. You know, verses, come to me, is talking about a relationship with an individual, right? So the difference between a list of ideas that I'd have to believe in first in order to meet this person, or just meeting this person. And so then when we talk about sharing the gospel or preaching the gospel, you know, I have this relationship with Jesus. And instead of like going, oh, I need to get my ideology to all these other people, I just go, hey, you should get to know this person, Jesus, more. And then I can allow Jesus to take over that conversation, right? As if because he has the agency to do that. And this began a shift in me of going, oh, this isn't a set of beliefs that I have that then get me to relationship. This is just, I come into relationship and I let that relationship transform me. You know, and I think that we've, if you've grown up in the church, or we often give this idea of like ideas that I need to adhere to. So this was a popular one and still is. You'll see this in tracts that are given out, right? And this is like the salvation plan. So the idea is like man is on one side and God is on the other, and there's no way to get across the chasm of death. But then the cross has, you know, made a bridge to get us to the other side. And I, being an artist, never liked this because it was only a two-dimensional image. And I was like, what if you look at it from a three-dimensional perspective? You know, oh, no, go back. Like, you know, you have this giant cross and you're going across, but then you're like, oh my gosh, does anybody have a ladder? How do we get over that? Like that, I don't know how to get over that part of it. It seems like just another obstacle. Right? And what I don't like, it's a joke, right? And my Aunt June was like, well, you could lay the cross flat and then go across it. And I was like, I know, Aunt June. But I think it actually, it's a great, it's a fine idea, but I think it actually hits at a deeper idea that maybe we have. And so, look, I love Indiana Jones. And there, you remember, if you've seen The Last Crusade, there's this scene, right? So there's this chasm that he can't cross. There's no way. And he's like, I've got the manual. I've got the directions. If I just know the directions and there's this uncrossable chasm and I believe them in my heart, right? And then I have faith, so I take the directions and I believe in my heart and I step out in faith with those directions, there will be, oh, and Kurt and I were talking about how our minds were blown when we were kids and we saw this for the first time, right? There'll be a way unseen that I didn't know about, and that's fine, except that's all up to us. And I don't think that salvation or knowing God is actually up to us. And I think there's a way of crossing an uncrossable chasm, a better example, and I would like to show you in this clip.
Jean-Francois Gravelet, better known as Blondine, was a famous tightrope walker and acrobat. He's perhaps best known for his many crossings of a tightrope, 1,100 feet in length, suspended 160 feet above Niagara Falls in the USA. His act would be watched by large crowds and begin with a relatively simple crossing using a balancing pole. Then he would throw away the pole and amaze the onlookers. On one occasion, he crossed the tightrope on stilts. On another occasion, blindfolded. Another time, he stopped halfway to cook and eat an omelette. In 1860, a royal party from England came to watch Blondin perform. After his normal spectacular crossings, he then wheeled a wheelbarrow from one side to the other as the crowd cheered. Next, he put a sack of potatoes into the wheelbarrow and wheeled that across. The crowd cheered louder. Then he approached the royal party and asked the Duke of Newcastle, "Do you believe that I could take a man across the tightrope in this wheelbarrow?"
Yes, I do, said the Duke.
Ah, hop in, replied Blondin. The crowd fell silent, but the Duke of Newcastle would not accept Blondin's challenge. Is there anyone else here who believes I could do it? Asked Blondin. No one was willing to volunteer. Eventually, an old woman stepped out of the crowd and climbed into the wheelbarrow. Blondin wheeled her all the way across and all the way back. The old woman was Blondin's mother.
The only people who ever got in the wheelbarrow with Charles Blondin was his mother and his manager. Both people who didn't necessarily trust in his abilities, but knew the character of the person they were trusting in. And I think to be a people who would stand before a king and go, but even if he doesn't, it comes out of a place of trust and faith that goes, it's not about the things I believe in, but it's in the character and the qualities of the character I know about this God. And I wonder if we could be those kinds of people. What does it look like to be in a rhythm of knowing the God who loves us and cares for us and says, I will be with you in all things. But here's another part of the story that I have a hard time with. It's the suffering. It's the part about like being cast into a furnace, right? Because that doesn't sound fun. And that wasn't on my list of things to do with my life, is to possibly be killed for something that I believe in, right? And it reminds me of a story in the Bible, another story about some guys who were following Jesus, and they kind of came across the same place. So there's a story in the New Testament about Jesus, and he's got these followers, right? And by the definition of followers, they follow him everywhere that he goes. So this one day, Jesus gets into a boat. You can go to the next slide. And they, because they're followers, they get into the boat with him. And then they go out to sea, and then out of nowhere, it says this crazy storm came out of nowhere, and the wind picked up and the waves picked up. It said that it was so crazy that they were afraid they were going to drown. Look, some of these people were professional sailors, so this is like the worst episode of The Deadliest Catch, right? And it says that these guys were like looking for Jesus, and I don't know how big this boat was. Like I imagine, you know, it could have been huge. It could have been like Diddy's yacht or something, and they're running around, and they're like, where's Jesus? I don't know. He's not in the discotheque. I can't find him, right? But it's most likely a group of guys, and guys are horrible at looking for things. So they're probably like, where's Jesus? Oh, he's right here. And when they find him, do you know what he's doing? He's sleeping. Kind of seems like the jerk move in that moment. And so they wake him up, and they're like, you got to do something about this. And he responds to them and says, why do you have such little faith? And they're probably like, because we're going to die. And then it says Jesus stands up, and he speaks to the wind and the waves and says, be still. And it all gets still. And then it says the followers looked at Jesus, and they said, who is this man who can control the wind and the waves? And what I don't like about this story is that it's a story about some people almost drowning. And look, I almost drowned, and it was an awful experience. So I learned how to surf in Washington State, which learning how to surf in Washington State is a lot different than California. Because in California, I'm guessing they're like, bro, what should we do? I don't know, ocean, right? And in Washington State, you're like, I got something to prove. And so you go out in the cold, in the froth, and all that stuff. And so, but I was on vacation with my family in Southern California, and a bro hooked me up with a surfboard and a suit, and so I was going out every day because I like to carpe diem. On one such day, the waves were a bit bigger than I feel comfortable with, and so, but because I was carpeing the diem, I went out. And look, if you're going to learn to surf, there are a few rules you need to know about, and that's when, one of them is when the wave is going to go like this, you don't want to be here, because if you are, like I was, all that 12 feet of water will push you down into the dark, and you begin to tumble around, and you lose track of where you are, and it's a very horrifying experience. And if you ever find yourself there, another rule that you need to know about surfing is don't panic, right? Because look, you got a wetsuit on that's pretty buoyant, you're hooked to a big piece of fiberglass, you're eventually going to get to the surface, but that's only really dependent on how much water is keeping you down. And I had a lot of water on me, and I didn't have a good breath. And I remember getting to the end of my breath, and maybe you've ever been in an accident or something traumatic, and you can think back to that moment and everything, it was in slow motion. I remember in that moment going, oh, this is when I die. I have some ideas of what's going to happen on the other side of this, but I'm not really in charge of any of it, am I? So that will occur. What's going to happen to my body? Like, it's going to eventually come up to the surface, and somebody will see me in the white water, and they'll bring me in, and I don't have any ID on me or anything, and they're going to, like, take off my wetsuit and probably try to do CPR, but only 5% of people ever come back when you resuscitate them. Baywatch lied to you. And And so then they'll call an ambulance and they'll come and take me away. And like, when does my family come and check on me? It's not unnatural. It's not abnormal to go surfing for like 3 to 4 hours. So is it hour three, hour four? They come to the beach and then they're looking for me. And I come out of the water and I was like, I think I'm done carpe dieming, right? So, and I know that might be a little hard to relate to, but look, we were all kids at one moment in our lives. And if you weren't, would you talk to me afterwards? But remember when you were a kid and you went to the pool with your friends and inevitably you began to wrestle together. And at some moment you found yourself underneath that body of prepubescent bodies like a tapestry keeping you from air. And you were like, guys, it's not funny anymore. I can't breathe. Hey, guys, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And you began punching your friends in places you never thought you would, right? It's scary. It's scary and frightening to find yourself there. And that's where the followers found themselves. And he's asleep. Like, why is he asleep? Sometimes it feels like he's asleep in our depression, our abuse, our divorce, our tragedy. Like, why is he asleep? That's why we should talk about butterflies. Cucumber. Can we talk about butterflies? Guys, do you know how butterflies are made? You're all pretty educated crowd, so I think you have a pretty good idea. And it goes something like this, right? There's a caterpillar, and he's like, I'm hungry, right? And so he begins eating a bunch of leaves, and then he's like, I'm tired. And so he makes a chrysalis and gets inside of it. And then after a month, he comes out, and he's like, I'm fabulous. And he's a butterfly, right? And that's pretty much how butterflies are made. There's some really interesting details, though, in between. And look, this is the only video I can find, and it's a little crude, and it's not me. But if you were to find, go to this, if you were to find a chrysalis and open it up, and the caterpillar had just got in it within 24 hours, what would you find in there? A cozy caterpillar in a sleeping bag? No, you would find a big bag of goo. You would find a sack of snot-looking substance, because within 24 hours, when a caterpillar gets into a chrysalis, it completely dissolves to a cellular level. It loses all shape in all form. It's just a bag of goo. And look, it's not like caterpillars thousands of years ago got together and be like, I think we should change how we're made. No, this is how it's always been made. And so, next slide. We have writings from scientists in the 1600s who were discussing this phenomenon. And at a time when religion and science weren't so far apart, it went something like this. They said, look, there's an animal in our world that dies and becomes a different animal. Is that what happens to us? And if we do die and become something different, would we even remember what we were before? Would we even remember the life beforehand? Not too long ago, you can go to the next slide, some scientists from Georgetown University decided to test this idea. So what they did is they gathered a group of caterpillars that were going to become moths. And one group, they said, be caterpillars and be merry. And then to the other group, they were like, we have plans for you. So what they did is they took this group of caterpillars and they exposed them to a scent. And it wasn't a smell that caterpillars have any opinion about, right? But every time they smelled this scent, they would get an electronic zap. So smell, zap, smell, zap, smell, zap, to where the caterpillars hated the smell. And you know when caterpillars hate a smell when they do this, right? So they hated the smell, and then it came time for them to make their chrysalises, and they got in their chrysalises, and they had to wait a month. And the big question was, when they come out and they're these moths, will they remember that smell? They remember they hated that smell. And so it came time, and they broke out of their chrysalis, and they were these beautiful moths, and so they exposed them to the smell again, and guess what? They hated the smell. And so the scientists knew that some part of the consciousness, some part of that brain was making it through that completely dissolving process. Another story. In the 1700s, a Dutch biologist named Jean Swammerdam, real name, gathered his colleagues together and he said, look at here. And he took a little tiny caterpillar and a little tiny scalpel and he made a little tiny incision, because everything with caterpillars is little and tiny. And he made this little tiny incision and he opened it up and he said, look here, look here. Right underneath the surface of the caterpillar is the beginning stages of wings. In the beginning stages of antenna. See, what happens when a caterpillar gets into the chrysalis, those wings and those antenna move to the side of the chrysalis, and they wait there until that process is done, until it's the right time for them to come back and to complete the process. See, the story of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly isn't the story about something dying and then becoming something else. It's the story about it becoming what was always in there. I'd like to submit to us, the fair people of Portland, that the boat is our chrysalis. That there was a group of followers who had this idea of who they were following, and that was keeping them from really seeing who they were following. And Jesus was willing to take those people to a very frightening place where that idea would die so that their eyes would be open and they would go, I'm sorry, excuse me, who is this man? I would never say that God gave me the most difficult times in my life because that's too easy. But I will say that what I've learned about journeying as a human being is that it's taken a certain amount of darkness to see the light, and it's taken a certain amount of sorrow to find joy, and it's taken a certain amount of unbelief to find belief. And I wonder in the journey with these three guys who their whole system of life was taken away. They had no religion. They had no temple to go to. That at some moment they had to have the conversation about who is Yahweh? Who is this God? And even in the midst of a culture and a country that we don't belong to, will we still serve him? And the evidence of that work and that journey comes out in, but even if he doesn't, because we know who we belong to. You know, when you study story, and I teach a class on teaching or preaching and speaking, and the point of storytelling is about transformation. All stories are about transforming. Not necessarily good stories about transformers, because there are none, but I don't know. First one, Shia LaBeouf, that was pretty good. But all stories about transformation. And if you look at this passage, who is the person who's transformed in this passage? It's the king. This is a story about the king being transformed. In fact, over and over throughout Daniel, it's the king who's being transformed. And God was willing to take his people. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were like, what is the king doing? We got to get out and protest. And there's nothing wrong with protesting. But look, they weren't like out there trying to get their thing across. They just had a practice that then confronted the system that was put in front of them, and then that system tried to destroy them, and God stood by them. Because what happens when in suffering is that God is revealed, right? In the midst of the boat, they finally saw Jesus. In the midst of the furnace, an angel of God appears. Some people even say this is an early Christ figure. Who knows? But God appears in the midst of the suffering. And when God appears, it transforms those who don't know him, and they see him. And they're transformed. You can go to the next slide there. There we go. So, whatever we find ourselves in our life, I pray that we as a people of God and whatever journey you are, that you would know the character of the God who we love and serve and who has told us that we belong to him and he will never let us out of his hands. And that at any time of persecution or trials that we may find ourselves in, that we would have eyes to see that maybe something larger is going on. And maybe at this moment, we're not the main characters of the story. Maybe somebody else will be transformed, and God is using us to transform that thing. You know, and I take heart in this, in the last image, in these words of Jesus. And I've been thinking about this a lot. In fact, I made an art piece about it. But I think it's interesting that Jesus says, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. You will have trouble. But take heart. I have overcome the world. Amen.